Okay, I think we can start. Welcome, Vakasha.
Yes, it's
okay,
March
March.
27th. Is it March 27th or 20? What are we?
March 27th,
2023.
March 27th,
yes. And yeah. By the way, there was a nice ad for Torah in Motion, both the ethics conference, my summer trips, and the classes in the Jewish Link. If you get the Jewish Link, I tell you something, I was in Florida. The same Jewish Link we have here in New Jersey, we have in Florida. No, literally the same. It's not like they have Florida ads. It's the same sports scores from the local tri-state areas.
I made it to Florida.
Say again?
The ad we put in was in the Florida edition too?
Yeah, well, it's not the Florida. It's the same Jewish Link. They get it sent down there or something. It's not like an edition. It's
literally right. I hear.
Okay, let's get going, everyone. One thing I can't report is an article. I'm going to read it hopefully in the next week. Of 70 pages just came out from Aviad HaKohen. I don't know if he's ever spoken for Torah in Motion. Has he, Aviad HaKohen?
No, he has not.
He's a well-known figure in the religious Zionist world in Israel. His father, live and be well, Menachem HaKohen, Knesset member, right? He's Pinchas Pelli's nephew. So he's head of one of the law schools, a Gush graduate. He has a long article concerning 70 pages here concerning Rav Soloveitchik's candidacy for the rabbinate of Tel Aviv in 1935, the Chidat Ihagato Eretz Yisrael, and the mystery of him not coming to Israel. So a very, very long article that just came out. And I see already one of the people he thanks is Rav Dr. Aharon Adler, who I believe is currently giving classes right now. Oh, he also thanks me, I see. Okay, and Rav Moshe Lichtenstein. And so it's a very, it looks like a very complete article. I listened to the talk last week, and I misspoke. If you listen to it, I'm talking about the Rachman, Rabbi Rachman, and the candidacy for president. I said, and Professor Chaim Soloveitchik spoke against, it's reported he spoke against the Rav. I added a comment to the YouTube. I misspoke. Not that he spoke against the Rav, that he spoke against while they were considering Rabbi Rachman's candidacy. I never asked him this. I don't feel comfortable. But the story is that he came in, he spoke at the board meeting. He took out one man's Judaism and he read a few passages. So he spoke against Rabbi Rachman, or at least that's the story. Now, that's, I think, maybe the origin for something that's incorrect in Rav Schechter's book, which I'll read a few in a minute. I also have to thank David. David points out, although in a number of places, this drasha of the Rav that we're going to continue in a few minutes, we're in the middle, beginning of, before letter 18, where he really blasts Rabbi Rachman's approach, many places record this as an RCA convention. And David says he doesn't think so. He thinks it was a YU alumni. And he provided the link for the actual speech, which I can send anyone. And indeed, it was at a YU alumni gathering. It was not at an RCA convention. Some people I see get it right. Thank you very much for that, David. Now, let me tell you, I don't have anything else to do. Then let's get right to it. But just a few more points about this, the talk of the Rav and the impact on it that it had, because I said that many people have reported that this hurt his candidacy to be president of YU. Now, remember, the Rav wasn't president, and the Rav didn't make policy, but he obviously had a big influence. But the board made the policy. Yet, it is possible that it had a big impact. I'll give you some examples, and Moshe called my attention to this. When Rabbi Rachman passed away in tradition, I think it's 2009, you have an article by Norman Lamb. I have spade on him. A very nice article. And remember, they competed for the presidency. And he says, this is on page 10, he says as follows, that first of all, he mentions that the Rav publicly berated Rabbi Rackman in 1975, and he also says the annual convention of the RCA. This is Rabbi Lamb saying, he says it's an RCA convention. But I tell you it's not. It's a YU alumni gathering. So I wondered, I asked David, well, maybe it's so at the RCA convention, they have a special section for YU alumni, but I don't think so. It's a YU alumni. And then he says, Lamb's article, he says that this was, namely the Rav's public attack on Rabbi Rackman, was to an extent responsible for his failure to achieve any further promotion in communal office that might have been in store for him. He says that it was this powerful opposition to the Rav, combined with certain other considerations, that shattered Rackman's dream to succeed the late Dr. Belkin as the next president of Yeshiva University. And then he says this led to Rackman going to Israel as president and later chancellor of Bar-Ilan University. And Lamb says these factors should not be overlooked in writing the history of those stormy days when the destiny of YU was being determined. And I pointed out that it's precisely those stormy days and this history that is left out of Jeffrey Gurok's book. And it's probably too late now. I mean, other than Maury Weiss, who I think was on the board then, I don't think any board members are still alive, but there's got to be minutes. And, I would love to know behind the scenes, was this really the reason they didn't go with Rackman? Or, you would think Rackman had long involvement with YU. He was close to and had supporters among the wealthy folk on the Upper West Side and elsewhere. Although he was regarded as a bit radical. Remember, by going with Rabbi Lamb, that will take us into the era of centrism. Rackman was unquestionably modern Orthodox, even on the liberal side of modern Orthodoxy, even then. Lamb was, he had been editor of Tradition. He wasn't regarded as, he wasn't going to ruffle anyone's feathers. So that could be the reason, but that ties into the Rav's piece as well. Now, Lamb's article, I encourage everyone to read it because he basically charts the path of Rabbi Rackman and how towards the end of his life, and he attributes it to his great caring for Jewish women. But he really was led to at least what mainstream Orthodoxy sees as beyond the fold in terms of halachic decision-making his based in. But everyone needs to give Rabbi Rackman credit. He stood tall and proud in an era when modern Orthodoxy was doomed to extinction, or so everyone thought. Orthodoxy, in fact, was doomed to extinction. The future was conservative Judaism. And he, together with the Rav, were really among the major interpreters of what it means to be halachically observant in modern times. And Rackman was a big popularizer of this. So it's true that at the end, he sort of moved out. Still in Orthodoxy, but very much on the left fringes. He was always liberal, but he lived a very long life. So you have to look at the first seven decades of it as well. Incidentally, speaking of another figure who moved extremely to the left, Rabbi Cardozo. I don't know if he's spoken at for Torah in Motion, but someone coming out of the regular yeshiva world. By now, he's on those way, way left, even maybe to the left of open Orthodoxy. You can look online. He has the strongest defense, I think, of Rabbi Rackman that you'll find online. And it's he writes about how he's very disappointed. The Rav didn't have the courage of his convictions. He takes it as a given that Rabbi Rackman's correct. And so if you want to see a strong defense of Rabbi Rackman against Rabbi Soloveitchik, you can look at Rabbi Cardozo. And if you want to see a halachic rejection of Rabbi Bleich, again, halachic, without even getting into the Rav's point that we're going to get back right into, that this is this ontological, it's ontological that the women need to be, they want to, be with a man no matter what a whole life he is. They prefer that. Irene emails me that she doesn't understand this. She says, in her experience, men have it much more difficult to live by themselves than women. And she says, research backs that up as well. But I just will mention Rabbi Bleich has a long article called Kiddushei Taot. I can't find it in his volumes of halachic writings, but it's in Tradition 99. So I don't know why it's not there. And also Rabbi Jachter. who's spoken also many times, I believe, for Torah in Motion, in Gray Matter, his volume and Halacha, volume one, they both are very strongly critical of Rabbi Rachman and is based in simply on the idea that you can void marriages, leaving aside, they don't even have to get to the Rav's position. He mentions it, as I recall, Rabbi Jacht or Bleich, I don't know if he mentions it at all. And Rabbi Bleich says that he rejects the idea that what Rabbi Rachman said, that psychological abuse, adultery, sexual molestation, et cetera, or even the withholding of a get may be viewed as indicating a sadistic nature. Remember, I told you that Rabbi Rachman explained to me that if a man withholds the get, it shows he's sadistic. And this was already part of his nature before they got married. I didn't know if that was ever published in print. I mean, it was put in print, but it was. They, the Beis Din of Rabbi Rachman actually defended their approach, and they wrote about it, and Rabbi Bleich picks it up, and he argues against this. He says that people, he argues, first of all, from the notion of free will, that even if you say that someone had this tendency, that's not a mekach talos, because, you know, if it was a good marriage, that he would have lived an entire life without this coming out. People have free will. Rabbi Bleich compares it to blindness. He says if someone gets married to someone else and the other person is blind and they don't know that, that's a mekach talos. But if you marry someone and then 20 years later, the person develops blindness and the doctors tell you that the symptoms for this, that is what caused the blindness, was already present from birth, let's say, that's not a mekach talos, Rabbi Bleich said. That's something that develops in marriage. Not everything that's there latent is a mekach talos. Rabbi Bleich says character defects are viewed that we're not determinists. He says character is formed either by physiological predisposition or by antecedent events or a combination of the two. And he goes on and says that although Judaism does not deny that character is molded by forces, it does insist that the will remains free. So, and the same basic argument is made by Rabbi Jachter as well. That, he says the fact that a man has an abuser personality does not ensure he will abuse his wife. Basically, both of them say exactly what I said in my discussion with Rabbi Rachman. And that explains why it wasn't accepted. Okay, a couple more things. So here I'm holding Rabbi Rachman's One Man's Judaism, the second edition. Published in 2000, which, by the way, has a review of my biography, Rabbi Chayak of Weinberg. And he, on page 409, he defends himself. And he defends himself in the other article that I wrote in 1985 in Shema. I recorded that the Rav says to him, you look at halacha historically, I look at it meta-historically. Here he's a little stronger. He says it's a pity that Rabbi Soloveitchik did not have the courage to help women more than he did. I think Rabbi Soloveitchik would be offended by this because it's not that he didn't have the courage. That's the language that Cardozo, I think, uses. Cardozo says he wasn't able to take his ideas to where they should have gone. It's not that Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't have the courage. It's not like cases where you have poskim who believe that the Mechayek of Weinberg was like this. They believe the halacha should be X. They think the sources all say this, but they don't have the courage. They say, who am I to be mater? Who am I to say this? That's poskim who don't have the courage. And I'm not saying this is a bad thing. Not something you're supposed to be what they call the yir hara, fear of, not every posek can just be fearless. Ramosha Feinstein was fearless. But that's not the issue. The issue here is not that Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't have the courage. And he says that when it came to Jewish education, the Rav was a standard bearer. He also said he would never assign a heter me'rabanim to allow a woman to marry. But he says the Rav did not have the courage. I don't know. I think he's, and then by the way, the very next page, page 410, listen to Rabbi Rachman. Blue Greenberg had written and said, where there is a rabbinic will, there is a rabbinic way. What David Eisen quoted, Rav Chassin is paraphrasing. Im tirtzu ein zo halacha. That's a play on Herzl. If you wish it, it's not an agadah. So he says, Boo Greenberg had written and said, where there is a rabbinic will, there is a rabbinic way. That is not heresy. It was the way of the oral law from the days of Moses. So Rabbi Rachman is agreeing 100% with Lou Greenberg. Now, there's a rabbinic expression that someone prophesied and didn't know what they prophesied. Because looking at it one way, Lou Greenberg is absolutely correct, but not the way she intended it. So she says, well, there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way. And so what do I mean that she's correct in one way of looking at it? Because at the end of the day, he cited her where there's rabbinic will, there's a rabbinic way. She said, where there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way. Because at the end of the day, take a figure, a great, great figure, like the Chasam Sofer. At the end of the day, if the Chasam Sofer becomes convinced that something is mutter, and he poskins this, that's then going to become the halacha. You can cite all the Gemaras in the world you want, but at least for his followers and for many, it'll be enough. If Ravadi Yosef would say something, you can cite all the proofs or Moshe Feinstein you want against them, but that's going to be become an acceptable position. So factually, it is true. Where there's rabbinic will, it becomes halachic way. But that's not what Boo Greenberg means. She means that all you need is the posek to say, I want it, and then to do it. And therefore, her implication is that poskim, you should want there to be, let's say, no agunas. So therefore, just make the decision, and it goes away. But that's poskim don't operate that way. So it's correct that if you have a great posek who says something and feels a certain way, then that does become the halacha in almost all cases, even if a lesser figure, they would throw him out of the base medrash for coming up with what they think is really a far-out argument. But that's not what Boo Greenberg. She wants consciously to say, simply because I want it, therefore go ahead and create the argument based on that. So I think it's much more complicated than how Boo Greenberg has it, although obviously the rabbi has to want it. If it's no accident, I was reading something from Neria Gutel over Shabbos. He shows that in the debate over the census in Israel, all the religious Zionist poskim rule that the census is permissible. All the Satmar type and the super Haredi, they all rule it's usher. It's not an accident, because if you value the state of Israel, then that becomes one of your considerations in ruling Lakula. Now, before I go on, I just want to say two more things. We're going to come back to Rabbi Rachman in a minute, because I think this is important even before continuing with the Rav, because it's very relevant to what we did last class. Remember, the Rav spoke. Just hold on to the end. Hold on to the at the end. We'll stop you. If you recall, the Rav used the term Chachmei Masorah, and he said that in order to decide halacha, you know, need to be part of the Chachmei Masorah, and I said that he's the first one to use it, the expression. It's really not. I remember it after I was listening to it, Rav Moshe uses it. So the Briskers are the first to use it. And in an article in Hakira, Moshe Fuss has an article about Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. And he cites an example where Moshe Soloveitchik used this expression, Chachmei Masorah, but for Moshe Soloveitchik, it only means the Tanaim and the Morai. That's who he's referring to. The Rav is referring to all Rishonim, Achronim, one who's in the tradition of the Rabbanim. Now, the last thing I want to tell you before moving on, if you go on Otzar Chachma, you plug in Chachmei HaMasorah, the Rav, he loves this expression. He says, "Kol Chachmei Masorah Mimos Moshe." He talks about in one of his famous essays in Uvikashta Misham. He speaks about how he grew up in the together with Chachmei Masorah. He says the achas, our connection, was a personal one. The Rambam Mimini, Rabbeinu Tam Mismoli, Rashi was sitting in front. If you recall that story of the Rav, where he tells, where, you know, all these gedolim are sitting on the side of me and we're arguing and they're still alive. Those are the Chachmei Masorah. The last thing I want to share with you before I return with the Rav's letter, with the Rav's attack on Rabbi Rachman is something Rav Schachter said. That Rav Schachter, where is it here? He talks about this letter. He talks about the Rav's attack on Rabbi Rachman. And this answers the question we had last class. This is in Mipnine HaRav, page 341 in the new edition. He says that there is a rabbi. He doesn't mention his name. He says, Rav Orthodox Yachad Yadua, a well-known Orthodox rabbi, at a gathering of rabbis said, in his opinion, the psychological assumptions of today that are not that a woman would marry basically anyone. He says, and he says, therefore, perhaps Rachman said, we can change certain halachot based on this. And then Rav Schachter says, Rabbeinu, Rav Soloveitchik, was very strongly against this, and he responded publicly. He doesn't say the RSA dimension. He says at Yeshiva University in a shiur before the Musmachim. So that's the rabbinic alumni. And he says that the Rav explained, although this is not found in the what Rav Schachter says is not found in the talk at all. But he says that the Rav explained that even though we have chazakas that change. So for example, there's a chazaka David asked last class, Ein Isha Me'iza Paneh Bifnei Baalah, that the woman's not going to, you know, publicly lie. She's having a machokes. She's having, you know, there's a din advari between her and her husband, and she's going to say in front of him something that she's not going to lie publicly. He's not going to lie right in front of him. The Rav could say, he quotes the Rav as saying, now, the Rav didn't say that at this talk. It's not in the transcript. It's not in the tape. But he could have said it another time. The Rav said that could change. And he says that the halachas therefore would change. He says the Rav said there's another halacha in Yoredeya. You have a chazaka that nosa David agui, something which you're not going to say something false, which then could come out later that everyone sees it's false. You're going to lie when you think you can get away with it. You're not going to lie if there's a chance that it could become known. And he says that the Rav said that today people are not embarrassed to lie. And the Rav, Rav Schachter quotes the Rav as saying something which definitely wasn't said at this time. And I don't know if he's misremembering or whatever, because he says, or the Rav misremembered, that the Rav said that at the UN, Kennedy turned to Khrushchev at the UN during the Cuban Missile Crisis and said to him, do you have missiles in Cuba? And Khrushchev said in front of everyone, and he said that this was on the news, the television, that no. And then Kennedy showed the entire world pictures of the missiles. Well, and it didn't bother Khrushchev. Well, I mean, there's an element of truth here. There was an American ambassador at the UN, and there was the discussion, but Kennedy wasn't at the UN with Khrushchev. There never was this confrontation together with them when he pointed to him and they asked him this, and Khrushchev said no. It never happened. Khrushchev didn't come to the UN to argue this, and Kennedy wasn't there with him. So you have a this is an issue with Rav Schachter's books, that often you have things that aren't necessarily correct. And I'll give you an example, but the idea is correct here. And so then Rav Schachter says, so then why is this any different? Why did the Rav think this is different, the case of Tavol Meitav Tandu, that we assume that the woman would rather be married? We don't, if the other chazakos change, why doesn't this one change? And Rav Schachter said the Rav felt this way because it's written in a pasuk. That something he says in this case, Chazal were not just deriving this from their view of the situation they lived in. Women's psychology, he says, Lamdu, they learned this mea psukim. And we saw that the Rav quoted the psukim. So we'll leave that at there. Now in Mipnini HaRav, also this book on page 217, Rav Schechter says something which it's just not true. I hate to say it, but it's not true. He says that after Rabbi Belkin died and they had to choose a new president for Yeshiva University, Rabbi Soloveitchik decided that one of the candidates, namely Rabbi Rachman, is not worthy of being president because of his untraditional views. Now, it could be the Rav thought that. Rachman denied it. Could be the Rav thought it. If the story with Chaim's okay is true, maybe that's the case. What's not true, though, is what he says next. He says that Rav Soloveitchik gathered all the Rosh Yeshiva together, and they put together a letter to the board of Yeshiva University that Rabbi Soloveitchik formulated a letter to the board of Yeshiva University that he opposes Rabbi Rachman being appointed, and he signed his name at the bottom, and he gave this to all the other Ramim at YU and to sign. Now, that never happened. The Rav never wrote such a letter, never got all the other Rosh Yeshiva to sign such a letter. How do I know that? Because someone from the board of YU, I spoke to someone from the board of YU. Well, first of all, it doesn't appear anywhere else. And Rabbi Rachman wouldn't have said that the Rav supported it if that was the case. And I've spoken to a lot of people. I even spoke to someone who was on the board of YU. So this is, as far as I know, this is nothing, such a thing never happened. I never heard of it. No one I spoke to who was involved ever heard it. Actually, no, two people who were at the discussions, they never heard it. So how could it be true? But then the interesting point is, he says that one of the Ramim, the Rosh Yeshiva, asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, why are you so upset with Rabbi Rachman? And Rabbi Soloveitchik is reported to have said that Rabbi Rachman accepts the second Isaiah. That is, there are two Isaiahs, not just one. And therefore, anyone who says that it was written by two separate people, Api Korasu, is a heretic. And he can't be appointed president of Yeshiva University. So according to this, you have him calling Rabbi Rachman Apikoros because he accepts second Isaiah. And Rav Schechter continues that in Abar Ben El, he also sometimes says strange things against the tradition. And Rav Schechter records him as saying, Rav Schechter's not there. These are sometimes Rav Schechter's there, he records it. Other times it's what he's told. It's, and even he says sometimes Shamati. That's when you need to be very careful, because when he's just reporting what he's heard, and this is something he wasn't there, he's reporting what he heard. So then what did the Rav reply? I also wouldn't want a Barbanel to be president of Yeshiva University. And with that, the dispute ended, and all the Rosh Yeshiva signed this letter, and it was given to the board, and his candidacy was finished because of that. So, I don't, it's a bubble myself. Unless someone can come up with a proof that it's not, never heard this, never recorded anywhere. The people, men on the board I spoke to, and one of the people who was involved in the discussions over the president, no one's heard of such a thing. And the fact is that Rachman never says that about the second Isaiah. What he said in his article and what's in One Man's Judaism, he doesn't say that he accepts second Isaiah. What he says is as follows on page 248 and 249. He says that I'll read you the exact words. He says a volume recently published makes an excellent argument for the position that there was but one Isaiah. But must one be shocked when it is opined that there may have been two or three prophets bearing the same name? No sage of the past ever included in the articles of faith a dogma about the authorship of the books of the Bible other than the Pentateuch. That sounds very much like a Barbanel. But so it's not like Rachman, as Rav Schechter says, it's not like Rabbi Rachman wrote an article Adam. He never wrote that. What he said is he doesn't think it's heresy. Now, what is the article, the book? We've mentioned this already. The book he refers to as having been written arguing that there is one Isaiah, that book was written by this woman, a woman who is not really known. She should be. Everyone knows Nechama Leibowitz. How come people don't know Rachel Margoliot? Rachel Margoliot, a great biblical scholar from an important family, as we'll see, she wrote the book, Echad Haya Yishayahu. She also wrote Eov, Kamoshahu, and another book about Har Sinai, as it's understood by the Rishonim and Achronim. She lived a very long life, died in 2009. Why is Rachel Margoliot not known? In traditional Torah learning, as well as a daughter of a rabbi, as well as an academic scholar. So why she's not known, I don't know. Her husband was this individual, Mordechai Margoliot, or Margolis, taught at the seminary for many years. He's a he edited Encyclopedia of the Sages of the Talmud, the Goni, most important, his edition of the Midrash Vayikra Rabbah, as well as other works. Great, great scholar. Her brother, she had three brothers. One brother is Rav Yitzchak Kulitz, Chief Rabbi of Jerusalem. The other brother is Chaim Kulitz. Chaim Kulitz, who wrote the biography of the Chazon Ish, many things he wrote, but it's Achoze Milita. If you can get the book, it's worth getting it, because the reason it's worth getting it is because that's where he describes the Chazon Ish's wife and the difficult relationship, which everyone knew, but he actually wrote about. It's interesting. And a third brother is Zvi Kulitz, who I think one of you, because we mentioned him in the previous class, knew him. He's famous because he's the one who wrote, you see it on Wikipedia, Yossel Rockover Talks to God. This was a fictional story that he wrote, the Holocaust story. And people thought it was published in a newspaper in Buenos Aires, and then it was republished. And people thought it was an authentic, and it was translated to English and Hebrew and appeared in, as it says here, in Holocaust anthologies. They thought it was a real testimony from the Warsaw Ghetto. But only later in his life, as it says, was he able to reclaim, capture his story and claim it as his own. So that's the Kulitz family. Okay, let's return to our story now. I want to pick up with the Rav's letter, with the Rav's drasha. If you recall, last class, we did about half of it, and one of the things I mentioned was the Rav identifies as a... First, he says it's close to heresy, and then he refers to it as heresy. That is machish magideha. If you deny the authority of those Chachmei HaMasorah, transmitters of the Masorah, it seems to be a contradiction. I suggested that perhaps he's referring, and I'm going to, this, what I'm going to say now is, I think can support this, that if you say this about the sages of the Talmud, then it's a heresy. If you say it about later authorities, it verges on heresy, because I should have stressed one more point. After mentioning Machish Magideha, he says as follows, even if you admit, those who admit the truthfulness of Torah Shebaal Peh, but are critical of Chachmei Chazal as personalities, who find fault with Chachmei Chazal, fault in their characters, who say that Chachmei Chazal were prejudiced, which had an impact on the, and this prejudice had an impact on the halacha. In the text here, as it's transcribed, it says, if you say that Chachmei Chazal were prejudiced, which actually has no impact upon the halacha, this is a mistake. It should be, which had an impact on the halacha, such a person is considered a kofer. So that's what Rav Soloveitchik says. If you say that the reason the rabbis have certain halachot, which maybe women come out, you think, on the short side, is because the rabbis were reflecting prejudices of their time, that sort of thing, that Rav Soloveitchik says you're basically denying the authority. You're casting aspersions on the transmitters of the Torah. And that's what he means. It says, if you were kofer, in the, not just of the Perushim of the Torah Shebaal Peh, but also Hamachish Magideha, the truthfulness of Chachmei Chazal, not of the Torah, but of Chachmei Chazal's personalities, of their philosophy. So that's an important point. But again, Rachman wasn't saying that. All he was saying was that they were reflecting an era, the women in their era. Now, the Rov picks up. Let's continue with the Rov. Before we get to, and again, this is all, we might not even get to the letter today, but this is all a preface for the Rov's letter, the short letter, which he explains why and the difficulty it was for him to publicly come out against Rabbi Rachman. So he continues in this drasha. As I mentioned last week, he was supposed to have drasha on Hilchos Geirus. And he decided that before that, he needs to speak about this matter. So before he gets to Hilchos Geirus, he talks about this. And he says that I was also told that it was recommended that the method of Afkinu Rabbanan Kiddushin be reintroduced. The idea that the sages are able to void conversions, void marriages. And I mean, this goes together with the idea that if the woman married and you say, well, had she known about these things in her husband, she wouldn't have married him. Okay, the rabbis can void the marriage. And that's really what the problem he saw with Rabbi Rachman's proposal. And the Rav says, if we start voiding marriages, then there will be no need for a get, he says. There will be no need. He says, we will be able to cross out this Mishnah, this halacha. Every rabbi will suspend the Kiddushin. And why? He says, why? You're going to say, well, that the chief rabbin of Israel, they're going to be the ones who have the authority to do this. The Rav says, it's not going to work. Why should this privilege be monopolized by the chief rabbinate? Why couldn't the RCA do it? Why couldn't any rabbi do it? So he says that this idea of which, once you start speaking about every marriage, who says the woman will want to be married, that's going to lead directly into a abolishing marriages. And then we don't have halacha anymore, he says. Now, my point is, though, you could have said that without, like Rabbi Bleich in his argument, you could completely reject the Rachman approach, as it later comes to fruition, the Rachman based in, without ever bringing in the idea that the chazaka remains the same. You don't even have to go there at all. You can still find fault with the idea that just because a man doesn't give a get, that means that he has a psychological problem, so it's mekachtos. In other words, you don't need to make the rule. But the Rav made that argument. And then listen to this language. I want to be frank and open. Do you expect to survive as Orthodox rabbis? He's speaking to the rabbinic alumni. Do you expect to carry on the Masorah under such circumstances? I hope that those who are present will join me in simply objecting to such symposia and to such discussion and debate at the rabbinical convention. And then the Rav says, when I was told about this, that there are rabbis, because Rabbi Rachman was talking about Afkinu, that the rabbis therefore can be uproot marriages. He says, when I was told about this, I thought, is it possible? He says, I can't imagine that at the Republican or Democratic National Convention, they would introduce a symposium on communism and democracy. And then later, he returns to it, but he only mentions Republicans. He says that, for instance, at the National Convention of the Republican Party, would anyone dare to speak about this sort of thing? It's speaking about changing the halachos of Chazal is at least as nonsensical as discussions about communism at the Republican National Convention. It's discussing self-destruction, a method of self-destruction and suicide. So this is as strong as you can get. But I love how the Rav brings in communism and the Republican, and not just the Republican. He throws in the Democrats also, because in those days, in the 70s, McGovern lost, and you still had a Scoop Jackson wing of the Democratic Party, John F. Kennedy Democrats. Today, I don't know. I mean, there's plenty of Democrats today who'd be happy to talk communism if they call it socialism, whatever. But no other Rosh Yeshiva, I think, would use that language. But it just shows you, this is the Vietnam era as well, how foreign this is and what a destruction of Torah Judaism this is. That even to question the chazakas of Chazal, not just the halacha, not just to say we're going to do afkinu, we're going to give the rabbis the authority to void marriages, but even to question the chazaka, the Rav sees as very, very dangerous. He says that, I know all the problems we're facing. I'm mindful of the challenges. But if you think that the solution lies in the reformist philosophy, he's calling Rabbi Rachman's approach a reformist philosophy. You are sadly mistaken. Then he says, it's self-evident many problems are unsolvable. You can't help it. For instance, the problem of Zerim and Eretz Yisrael. So this is a theme that the Rav would expand elsewhere as well. The idea of surrender. He even uses this language later, just a few sentences later. He says, this is Taurus Moshe. This is surrender. This is Kabbalah Solmach Hushamayim. We surrender. The Rav develops the idea, which he'll say at other times as well, that at times you need to just say, we surrender. We surrender to the yoke of the commandments. We don't have solutions to everything. And that's what it means to be a mamin, to be a believer. Just like we surrender in theological matters, we don't understand that, so too at times in halachic matters we surrender. He tells a whole story here about this couple. This non-Jewish girl becomes religious, becomes Jewish. She converts from Rochester for real. You know, she was convinced of the truth of Judaism, not for marriage. And then she meets a boy and who had no knowledge of Judaism. And she was Makariv him. She made him, she brought Torah to him. And they got engaged and they're in love and all that. And then they go to the cemetery. He wanted to find out about his family because he doesn't know anything. And they see this strange symbol with the hands and they investigate and shows he's from a family of Kohanim. He's a Kohen because it would have been the paternal side. So they wanted to know, what could they do? The question came to the Rav. This is what a tragedy. She converts. He becomes religious. They want to marry. And the Rav says, you know, what can you do? Quote, what can you do? This is the halacha. The Kohen is usher to the Yoris. We surrender to the will of the Almighty. Now, there are poskim, at least Rav Moshe, he probably would have been Mako in this case, or at least we have times some of his students were Mako, because the idea that this is a non-religious family. And it's reported that Rav Moshe was very Mako in this, Rabbi Tendler or others, because the assumption is that if it's a non-religious family, we don't trust the yichus. The fact that it's on the cemetery, it doesn't matter. If it's a non, I don't know how far Rav Moshe took this. I know for a fact of two cases. For a fact, I know this. And I know one of the cases personally, where based on Rav Moshe, and two of them was from someone from Rav Moshe's family, the Kohen status was avoided because of it was not a religious family. And if you don't have a continuous yichus of Masorah, the fact that someone says they're a Kohen, they haven't been religious in 50, 100 years, this family, how do we rely on them? I think other poskim do not accept this. I think everyone generally assumes that if you're at the cemetery and you see the grave. Now, in the cases I'm talking about, well, I don't know. I guess it wouldn't matter, the grave, because if someone thinks he's a Kohen and he's not religious and he dies, they'll put it on his grave too. But I think most of the poskim assume that that's considered a good simon, and that even if someone's not religious, we can rely on the fact that he says he's a Kohen. In fact, in one of the cases I know, the person always was assumed to be a Kohen, only when to get married, now we're not a Kohen. So, it's a tough thing. It's a tricky thing because I know of a case, one of the cases I know of, where the other siblings are still Kohanim. So how do you have it where one is not a Kohen and you get married, but the others are still Kohanim? I don't know. But that was, I don't know. Again, I don't know all the details of Rav Moshe, but at least the Heter supposedly goes back to Rav Moshe. And I know for a fact, I know two cases personally, and I know of other cases. But the Rav says no. As far as the Rav was concerned, having the Kohen sign was enough. And what does the Rav say? We surrender. There are things we can't change, and that's part of Torah. He goes on to say, halacha, don't say that halacha is not sensitive to problems. On the contrary, he says halacha is very sensitive, but the halacha has its own orbit. And we can't always get the answer we want to halacha. The Rav says, there's sadness in my heart. I share in the suffering of the poor woman who was instrumental in bringing him back to the fold. And then she had to lose him. But you can't always get, you know, this isn't conservative Judaism. The conservative halachic theory, these hard cases, you fall back on conscience. at the end of the day, for the conservative rabbis, they'll try to show that he's not a Kohen. But if he is a Kohen, they'll say, well, they've gotten rid of that. They'll say, you know, it violates our conscience or something. But obviously, Rav Soloveitchik couldn't say that. The only way you can allow this marriage is if you can find a halachic argument. And the Rav says no. And this idea of surrender. And then he goes on in the last paragraph. He talks about the Rambam. He says that anyone who speaks of halacha as a fossil, it's ridiculous. Now, I don't think Rabbi Rachman ever spoke about halacha as a fossil, or even Rabbi Berkowitz. But there were people in the non-Orthodox who spoke, and Rabbi Rachman and Rabbi Berkowitz did speak about how halacha should be moving more. It should be more creative. I don't think they ever used the word fossil. Fossil was the term used by Toynbee about Judaism, that it's a fossil religion. But so the Rav says, this is very important. He says, we are opposed to shinoyim, changes in halacha, but chiddush is the essence of halacha. There are no shinoyim in halacha, there are no changes in halacha, but there are great chiddushim. It's tricky to know what's a chiddush and what's a shinoy, because one person's shinoy would be another person's chiddush. It would be very hard to know what's, because the Rav is attacking something here as a change, where others might say it's not a change, it's a chidush. He says, but the Rav gives an explanation, at least in his, how he sees it. He says, chidushim are within the system, not from the outside. So a chidush that comes up with a new way of understanding the halacha, that is developed out of the halacha. So you can come up with a completely new halacha, a completely new understanding. Until now, you were doing X, and now you come up with it, and you say, no, this is not the way you do halacha. We have to do halacha this way. So the outsider would say, that's a change. It used to be this, and now it's that. And the Rav says, that's not a change. That's a chidush, because it came internally how you interpret the halacha. And what does he mean by an out shinoi? He tells us. He says you can't psychologize halacha. You can't historicize halacha. You can't rationalize halacha, because this is something foreign, extraneous. He says, can you psychologize mathematics? You can't give psychological reasons. He says why Euclid said two parallels cannot cross. It all mathematics has to be understood internally. And he says the same thing about halacha. The great irony here is that his own son, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, is one of the leading scholars in historicizing halacha. Now, granted, he doesn't historicize, he doesn't do chazal. He's not looking at chazal and explaining the rabbis of the Talmud, but he is doing it with Rishonim. I'm not sure if the Rav would be so much opposed to Rishonim. He's really speaking here about the sages of the Talmud. He does include the Rishonim as part of Chachmei Masorah, and he might see it inappropriate. But remember, that's not when he spoke about heresy. He specifically was referring to the sages of the Talmud. So that's the difference for the Rav. What's the difference between a Shinoi and a Chidush? A Chidush develops internally. So you can come up with a completely new way of understanding Halacha, and Reb Chaim did this on occasion. So it's understood completely different than what we did until now, but that's okay, because that's a Chidush. A shinoi, a change, is like a reform. Why the reformers change halacha? Because of outside pressures, because of outside ideas that cause them to reevaluate. So if you're going to change the position of women because of modern psychology, or because you say historically they're in a different circumstance, or any halacha, that's Reform Judaism. If you come up with a new way of understanding the halacha, it could be lakua, it could be a chumrah. The Rav had great chumras as well, but it could be lakua. So, for instance, we're coming up to Chol HaMoed. If you say that based out of the sources, you explain that if you look at the justifications, the reasons given why you don't do laundry on Chol HaMoed, why you don't shave on Chol HaMoed, and you look and you explain based on those reasons, and then you look at the Metzius and say that it doesn't apply anymore today, that's internal to the system. And that would, it's not a reform. It's simply applying the original understanding of the halakha, and so it's a new circumstance, and so now you can shave. That would be a chidush. But if you'd say something like, well, today, you know, it's considered, I don't know, uncouth not to shave, or the rabbis were influenced by this when they said that, or whatever, that would be a reform. So are you going to buy it, everyone? I think some people won't buy it, but I think it has an internal consistency. The problem is whether you accept the Rav's idea that everything is internal to the halakha. He's denying this outside influence on it. But once you accept that position of his, I think it's clear the difference, although for the outsider, you might say this looks like a reform, but it's clear it's not a reform because it's developed internally by using the system to come up with something. That's very different than being influenced by all these other forces. And then he concludes, instead of complaining about the inflexibility of halakha, let us explore its endless spaces and enjoy Talmud Torah and find in Talmud Torah a redemptive, cathartic, and inspiring reality. That's all I wanted to say. Now let's get to the shiur. So this whole piece, which I don't know if people remember the shiur on Geirus, but everyone remembers this. It's one of the classic statements of the Rav, sort of, I think it was ad-libbed, as far as I know. I don't think he had this written out. And it's become really a classic statement of the Rav on halakha, on you know, Chachmei HaMasorah, how we're supposed to relate to it, with all the questions. Does the Rav really mean that this chazaka is absolute? I think so. I think he means it. And I don't know if it's only because of the pasuk, or I'm not sure, though. It's questionable how to understand this, because it does seem to violate what we see with our eyes. Okay. So that's the Rav's strong attack, very important in the history of American Orthodoxy, post-20th century. It really set its – here you have the Rav, you know, really slapping down a leading modern Orthodox rabbi. And Rabbi Lamb says that this was one of the reasons why we didn't get the presidency. By the way, Jeffrey Wolf, he also has a piece on the Rav's understanding of Masorah. And he, first of all, he quotes, this is in note 6. He says that, like we heard from David Eisen, that Rav Lichtenstein has been quoted by close disciples as registering serious question as to whether this chazaka is impervious to change, as the Rav asserted. So, I mean, the Rav, his language, he says it's fira to say that this could change. But here, it's been reported that Rav Lichtenstein held that. Now, I don't understand, because Jeffrey Wolf says Rav Schechter also noted difficulties in the Rav's interpretation of the presumption. And he says that Rav Schechter also registered a question as to whether it's impervious to change. And what he cites is what I read you. And the way I read it, Rav Schechter is not registering serious question of the Rav. All he's doing is pointing out, you have these other chazakas. These other chazakas do change. What's the difference? And then he cites the Rav as explaining the difference. In fact, it wasn't just that. He cited the Rav as, he says the Rav himself explained the difference. But he does cite Rav Lichtenstein. Now, on the previous page in this article, which you can get on his academia site, on note 5, he says as follows. Let me just read it to you. And I wish I could ask the Rav this question. My student, Dr. Eliza Bazak, examined the use made of this presumption, namely Tavo Metotandu, by halakhic authorities over the course of half a millennium. She discovered, ironically, that prior to the post-war period, poskim overwhelmingly discussed this chazaka in two ways. One, in order to show that it did not apply, or two, to invoke it for the benefit of the woman. So I haven't seen, he cites her master's dissertation here, Hashimush, you know, using the chazaka of Tavametav in halachic discussions. I like to see the sources she cites. Because I said that Rav Moshe, I don't see how you can read Rav Moshe as accepting this, but so is the Rav Adas Yachid on this? Is the Rav a minority approach on this? That would be quite ironic if he was, and maybe would support the argument that the Rav was arguing polemically here. But it'd also be ironic because I can't tell you how many people in discussing the episode cite the Rav's position and his criticism of Rachman as the 14th Ikar Amuna. That what the Rav says about this chazaka is absolute, and if you deny it, you're saying kafira like Rabbi Rachman. If it's the case that we have a whole list of other poskim who say differently, then you can hold by the Rav's position, but to use it to attack other people and cast them as reformers and as heretics because they're saying that the chazaka might change. People on the right wing of modern orthodoxy pull this out all the time and say, as the Rav said, that to disagree with this is heresy because you're questioning the chazaka. As we saw, it's reported that Rav Lichtenstein himself didn't find this convincing. So I just find that of note. Let me, even though it's 9:27, let me just, I figure we spoke so long, let's at least do the letter, because it's a quick letter. Letter 18. I can't even remember who gave me the letter. And it doesn't have the name of the recipient, so I don't know who it is. It's handwritten by the Rav. Do I have it here? Oh, no, I don't have it here. But it's a handwritten letter from the Rav. And it's addressed to someone who calls him Rav Agon Ish Ashkolot, but I don't know who that is. And he simply says as follows. First of all, something was attributed to the Rav, so he says, I never said that. But I don't know what that's referring to. But then he says, 2 years ago, this letter, the Rav is writing this in 1978. Remember, he attacks the Rav. He attacks in 1975, 76, 75, Rabbi Rachman. He says that articles appeared. He's referring to Rabbi Rachman's article in the Jewish Examiner. And actually, the title of the newspaper wasn't the Jewish Examiner. I looked it up. It was called The Jewish Week and the American Examiner. And later it becomes The Jewish Week. Rabbi Rachman would have a column in that there for years. I'm sure many people listening to us now can remember Rabbi Rachman's weekly column that over the years became more and more on the left. Rabbi Lamb speaks about this in his eulogy. And the Rav says as follows. These articles are from our friend. He calls him Yedidinu. It's a few years after his great attack on Rabbi Rachman. He says, I'll give you the date is, yes, 1975. So this is Tammuz of 78. He says at the Rabbinic RCA convention, he said similar things to what he published in the newspaper. In other words, Rabbi Rachman spoke about this at the RCA convention, the idea that he was the president of the RCA. Not at that time, but at other times. He was a big macher, a leading figure in the RCA, one of the originators, founder on the board of tradition. So he said that Rabbi Rachman spoke about this at the RCA. He says, "Kishanodali hadavar acharkach," when I was heard about this later, namely, not the articles. He's meaning that Rabbi Rachman publicly at the RCA convention set forth his idea that Tavo Meitav Tandu should no longer be applicable today. He said, "I protested against the articles and the speech." The Rav says, "Kashahaya alai hadavar ma'od ma'od." He says ma'od twice. He says, "This was exceedingly difficult for me to do." Because this individual, Rabbi Rachman, is one of my faithful friends for many years. As I told you, they in the 1950s, Rabbi Rachman coordinated with Rabbi Soloveitchik his articles on how to defend the halachic system in the modern times, and they were very close for decades. He wasn't the Talmud. He was already from Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, but very, very close to the Rav. And the Rav says, nevertheless, despite the tsar, the pain that my protest caused me, he says, I couldn't remain silent. He says, I protested in the presence. More than 100 people were there. And so I think this letter is of interest because you see, unlike many of the followers of the Rav on the right wing, who as soon as this came out against Rabbi Rachman, then all of a sudden they begin referring to Rabbi Rachman as a kofer and out of the fold and citing the Rav. Here, and here you see the Rav doesn't have that response at all. You see the Rav is conflicted. And the Rav is saying, I did what I thought I had to do, but it was very painful for me because he's a good friend of mine. But I thought I had to do it. You know, this is Torah and I have to do it. Many of the students of the Rav, they didn't feel tsar. They felt like happiness that now they can blast Rabbi Rachman on the authority of the Rav. And they felt hana out of the way to like read him out of the fold. And the Rav doesn't feel this way. The Rav feels great pain. This is 3 years later. And you see, the Rav still feels it. He says, Kasha haya ladavar ma'od ma'od. Ki halo hui mi didai hanem manim ze rabo shanim. So we see that this was not an easy thing for the Rav to do. This wasn't something that he relished doing. And there's something that caused him a great deal of pain. But he felt he had to do it, just like it caused him a great deal of pain to tell the girl from Rochester she couldn't marry the guy. So I think it's important to show that, yes, the Rav did what he did. He felt he had to. He was honest. But his reaction is very different than many others who took it. They wouldn't say that I'm attacking Rabbi Rachman and it causes me great tsar. No, like I said, they got great hana because they could show finally they could throw him out. So important letter, I think, even though it's a very short letter. And we have three more letters. So next week, maybe we'll get to Mechitza. Notice we're getting all the big issues except for girls studying Talmud, which we'll do a few classes on the Helfgott book and we'll get to that. But, there's a scholar in Israel who wrote a piece on Eliezer Berkovitz. And in the piece, remember I told you the rabbi at Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's house, he didn't know this dispute and I couldn't understand it, but I looked it up. I looked at the shul website. He's not a YU graduate. He's not a YU Muslim. He went to YU. You knew this. So a guy in Israel, he actually thinks that the Rav's attack is against Eliezer Berkovitz. And he writes, Eliezer Berkovitz. And I wrote to him and I said, no, it's Rachman. And maybe he's thinking, you sure? This and how do you know? He doesn't mention Rabbi Rachman by name. It's like only someone living in Israel who doesn't know anything about American Orthodoxy. I mean, it isn't like this was like the talk of the town. This is like the whole, this was a major event. So, years later, someone could look at it and say, well, who was he attacking? Well, Berkovitz published an article, a book a few years before that. Tanayu Nisun Baget, and this person in the article speaks about, the Rav attacking, conditional marriages. It's not true. The Rav says nothing about conditional marriages. It has nothing to do with conditional marriage. That's a different issue, a different controversy. Can you have, that's Rabbi Berkovitz's proposal. The Rav doesn't mention that at all. The Rav is simply speaking about the Chazaka and Tava Meitav Tandu and Mafkia Kiddushin. But because the person in Israel didn't know that this was Rachman's position, he just assumed, had he asked literally anyone who went to YU from any musmach of YU from the 40s and to the 80s or the 90s, I think literally anyone would have told him it's not Berkovitz. But okay. David says, where was Professor Cohen's article published? It just came out. Dov Schwartz, Bar Ilan, edits this volume. They have like nine volume is now called Sionut Datit, and that's where it appeared. And I have a PDF. I could send it to anyone, or maybe I should ask permission. I can't say what I was given it. Now, these letters, which we're discussing right now, originally I thought of publishing them in the Dov Schwartz's volume, the Studies in Religious Zionism that comes out every few years. But then I thought, at the end of the day, this is more of an academic publication. And if I want the Olam to see it, Chakira is a better place. And to Aviad HaKohen, really, he should have published his article in Chakira, although he would have got maybe more readers. Nissen says, was the father of Menachem, the MK from Avoda? Yes, he was in the Labor Party. He was, for years, he was, let's see how old he is. There were three brothers. He was born in 1932. Yes, let me pull up a screen here so you can see it. And in the article, he has discussions with discussions his father had with the Rav. Now, so there was also Shmuel Avidor, yes. And his brother was Shmuel Avidor Akoe, and also Pinchas Peli. So well, this is a brilliant family. But he was in the Labor Party. You can have a rabbi in the Labor Party. Okay, let's see.
It was Ben called home, and Ben, that was
yeah. What'd you say?
That was a faction within the Labor Party known as Oved Hadati. It was made famous. I remember as a child reading in the whole LL debate on Shabbos, and Rabbi Cohen had to defend the Labor position. And Begin said about Rav Matam and the Knesset blew up, and he said, okay, it's a Rav Blitzam. That's,
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Thank you. Ben Moach says, isn't from last week the idea of Rabbi Soloveitchik Menacha just another way of saying Das Torah? When many, all of you stated that you didn't understand the Rav's reasoning, okay, you say it's Das Torah. Well, wait till next week, because next week we'll see. The proposal was that there should be for the Mizrahi like a Moetzes Gedolia Torah, and the Rav would be the Das Torah. So I'll talk about Das Torah next week. Now, here the Rav would say not Das Torah, because Das Torah means through the charismatic personality, through the connection through Torah, of learning Torah, the sage, the Gadol, intuitively knows what the answer should be, not just in halacha, but on everything, on who to vote for, on decisions. The Rav isn't saying that. He's saying that, if anything, he's saying that's the Das Torah of the Chazal. It's their Das Torah. But he's saying more than that. He's saying it's a Pasuk in Torah. Now, how do we know that this Pasuk in Torah implies for all time? After all, the Pasuk also says that the woman's going to have pain in childbirth. Are we going to say then that you can't use anesthesia? I don't know where you draw the line, but the Rav says that I don't see it as Das Torah. I see it as an understanding of how the halachic system works.
You're also saying that only he has this knowledge. You guys don't agree with him. He's inconsistent. And yet, because he has this ephemeral concept of meta halakha, you can't challenge it. And since we're in the Passover mode, we have the case of Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, who allowed chicken and milk, and it was honored while he was alive. And when he passed away, his Talmidim didn't feel bound by it.
I'm not saying it can't be challenged. We saw many people did, but the Rav wouldn't say. You might see it as like Das Torah, but the Rav wouldn't see it as Das Torah, because the Rav, it's not from his charismatic personality or his authority. He's saying that this is what he's not saying that I'm saying this. He's saying that this is what Chazal said. But I understand you, if you don't buy it, it does seem very much like Das Torah. It's the Rav saying that. This, you must accept this idea.
But you all so last week see. Said that you didn't understand, you thought he was inconsistent and didn't understand his reasoning, and yet you went along with it. So that's a form you guys treating him.
I said that you could, the Talmud that I spoke to, who said he didn't understand the reasoning, I said, for all I know, doesn't mean he rejects it. He might say, well, the Rebbe said it, so I accept it. But he was honest enough to admit that he didn't understand it. It's a, does this mean that you treat the Rav Soloveitchik like an Admor, because you don't understand it? I don't know. I don't think it's so much like an Admor, because in general, the tradition, at least in Orthodoxy, is even if you don't understand things, you take the psak of your Rav, even if you don't understand it, usually. Das Torah is not referring to halacha. That's the whole chiddush of Das Torah. It's dafka, not halacha. It's if the sage says, don't marry this person or vote for this person or things that are not halacha. That's the chiddush of Das Torah. The Rav here is saying that this is halacha. Yes, he's not arguing the way poskim usually argue. And you might say he's applying a Das Torah type of mentality to halacha, but it's not Das Torah. Das Torah is separate from halacha. We'll see even the Rav himself said that he never heard this expression Das Torah in Europe. Das Torah is, Rav Moshe also said he never heard it. I hope I can find it. Rav Tovia Goldstein, I think, has something about Das Torah in the book, if I recall this, and I gotta find it. But I don't know, but I grant, obviously, for those who don't buy what the Rav is saying, you're going to see him as arguing from authority based upon his psychological understanding, which can't be replicated, which is rejected by the very people who he's describing, namely the women, simply because the Rav is saying that this is the pshat in the pasuk, this is what Chazal mean, and it becomes even more complicated because we have other poskim who have a completely different approach. So it's one of the very troubling things I have with the Rav, and thank you, Mike, for providing the link already on Academia. Great. David, there it is. David says, do I find a connection between Rabbi Rachman's view of Tabmate of Tanvil and his liberal views regarding releasing women from Agunot? Yes, that's the whole idea. From halachic standpoint, he was able to release women from being an Aguna because you can't just release women from being an Aguna because you say, well, I don't want it to be an Aguna. His whole point was that all these men who the women can't get divorced from them, who beat them or anything, or even the fact that the man refuses to give his wife a get, that is itself a sign of a psychological problem with him, a cruelty, which itself made it a mekach tos. And the whole idea of mekach tos is based on Tavu Meitav Tandu. Because if you're going to say Tavu Meitav Tandu, then Mekach Taos doesn't work unless it's one of the ones already we see, like from the Rishonim or something, maybe second impotent. But other issue, or let's say he's a tenor or something. But the other issues, you cannot get out of a marriage. Why? Because Tava Meitav Tandu, we assume. So his whole Beis Din's approach goes back to Mekach Taos, which is inextricably tied to Tava Meitav Tandu. And I think that's what the Rav. And that's what you say. If so, that perhaps that's the reason he lashed out so sharply. That's what I said last class. But nevertheless, I find it hard to believe that it's subconscious, that it's conscious. It has to be subconscious because otherwise you're saying the Rav is engaging in rhetoric, in polemics. When he says it's a pasuk and based upon the pasuk, it's the women's nature. Are we saying he didn't believe this? He just was using this as a cudgel to beat Rabbi Rachman? He definitely believed it. He elaborates on it. But he does understand that giving in on this would lead to everything else. So maybe subconsciously that's forcing him to read it this way. I don't know, but I can't accept the interpretation of the Rav that some have offered that this is all polemical. If you read what the Rav says, it's not polemical. It doesn't sound polemical. There are other times where the Rav is polemical. We'll see. I think with the Mechitza, we'll maybe see an example of polemical. When I say polemical, it doesn't mean it's not true, but, it has a lot of exceptions to it. This seems very authentic to me, and the Rav lays it all on the line. I challenge anyone to really read from beginning to the end what the Rav says and not see this as authentic Rav. Chazaka, you quoted was a different amaze. Okay. Well, the Rav says the same thing. He says, as Rav Shachter quotes him, he says that today those Chazakas don't apply. So what's the difference? Because those were the sages saying that today, that people won't lie publicly. Today we see they will lie. And the difference is there's no pasuk in Chumash telling you that. That's how the Rav explained it. And David says, when you study in YU in 92, Shalom Karmi brought Tzvi Kolitzin to be a guest lecturer on Yossel Rackover in his course, Good and Evil in Jewish Thought. You know, it's a great story how a novel first becomes accepted as an authentic thing and everyone accepts it. We have other examples of this. Hey, the whole story of, what I'm going to give you is not intended to be a novel, but the story of the Beis Yaakov girls, the 93 Beis Yaakov girls who commit suicide. That was fraudulent from the beginning. and that became accepted as historical by some. But that was, here we have an example of where it was, the whole thing was intended to be a fiction, and yet people took it to be real. There's some other examples of that also. Off the top of my head, I can't think of them. Nissen says the kula of Rav Moshe includes the basis that our kohanim are sveike kohanim. Yes, that is an idea that's found in Achronim, that all our kohanim are not absolute. They're sufek kohanim, but many poskim don't accept that. But many poskim do accept that, and it's usually brought in as a snif. A snif is like when you're building a terim, it's like a branch. You bring it in, and someone privately says that Professor Moshe Halbertow is critical of the Rav's theory of surrender, pointing out that when the Halakha surrenders, someone else's life is sacrificed. That's sort of like what Cardozo, if you want to, what's his name again, Rabbi Cardozo? Anyone remember his first name? I'm forgetting now.
Nathan Lopez.
From Israel. Nathan Lopez Cardozo, yeah. I read what he wrote today because Irene reminded it of me. And I'm all for, if you want to disagree with the Rav, but Lopez Cardozo, I just think it's overboard. And it's just, and I don't like what Rachman says, to say that the Rav, the language that he uses, listen to this language. And I understand the Rav was upset to say the Rav Soloveitcher did not have the courage. It's not a question of courage. It's a question of a different approach to the halacha and how to view it. You might not accept it. You might not like it, but it's not that he doesn't have courage. It's not like he's afraid of being attacked by the right wing. It's not like he doesn't have the courage of his own convictions. Can't have the broad shoulders. He didn't believe it. So if you're going to reject him and say that he's off base, but don't say he didn't have courage. David says that Rav Kefet often tells about his four students, he thought, who are all brothers with the same father and mother, yet the two older brothers are Kohanim, while the second pair are not Kohanim, and uses this as a brain teaser for students. Well, the case is that if they're married, they have a couple of children, then they get divorced, the guy's a Kohen, they get divorced, and then they get remarried. They're not supposed to, but if they do get remarried, then the next two children would not be Kohanim, even though it's the same parents. But that's not the case that I was talking about. I was talking about a case where one person goes up and duchens and gets called up for the first aliyah, and the other person is now, I guess you could say, though, that the person who got married, he asked the shayla. He was told he's not a Kohen. This guy never asked the shayla. And who says he has to hold by this psak? But it's weird, because how could you? Okay, so Marty says the confrontation took place, as I described it, but it involved the American and Soviet ambassadors. Yes, that's what I remembered. It was the American ambassador. I knew it wasn't Kenny and Khrushchev. So that's an example of how, I don't know if it's the Rav. I would think it's Rav Schechter, I think, getting the facts wrong just in recording it. He said,
Andrei Stevenson was the American ambassador.
Yes, exactly. Thanks for reminding me. Andrei Stevenson. Rav Schechter told me that the Nefesh HaRav, although this passage wasn't with Bimini HaRav, but he said Nefesh HaRav had to be written in a year for the Yortzeit, and he said that he recorded things that he was told that he learned later were not 100% correct or not accurate. So there's a second edition. He corrected some of them. So he acknowledges that it's not everything is factual. And then the person who emailed me about Moshe Halbertow, he said it's a mistake. It was David Hartman. Yes, David Hartman in his last book. And I have to say, with all due respect, and thank you, Moshe, for sending me this great video that Rabbi Hartman gave, where he speaks about Chaim Berlin. He was there, and others speaking about the role of rabbis in modern times. I think it's a great video. But his last book, which I think is God is Not Afraid or something like that, it's hard for me to see Rabbi David Hartman as Orthodox after that book, because he basically is willing to do all sorts of things, including in Ishus, which are not Orthodox. But he's quite critical of Rabbi Soloveitchik in that book for for not doing what he should have done. It's getting late, so just take a couple more. David says, if the Rav contends that halacha is not subject to outside influence, I wonder what he thought about Rav Lichtenstein's article. Does Jewish tradition recognize an ethic independent of halacha? What Rav Lichtenstein is talking about, I think, is something different. He's saying that Rav Lichtenstein is basically expanding Torah. Not all of Torah is halacha. So we have natural law, we have things like that. The Rav is speaking about halacha. We're going to say that his Chazal decided that this should be the halacha on Sukkot because of their environment or Hanukkah, or they're influenced by like Rav Yaakov Ellman. You know, the Persian influence on Hilchos Nida, the way the rabbis decided that. That's the sort of thing that Rav Soloveitchik saw as just completely out of line, that when it comes to halacha, I don't know what the Rav would say about Agada, you know, because it's also a common thing among scholars to point out the various Agadot are influenced by that Zoroastrian society, things like that. But to bring it into the halacha, to say, like Yaakov Ellman did with Hilchos Nida, to say that these are influenced by Zoroastrian practices, that for the Rav is just out of bounds. Now, it's not a reform, what Ellman's doing, because he's not saying to change the halacha. But if you're going to start, change the halacha based upon that, saying that, since, you know, we see where this came from, that would be a change, not a chidush. So many good questions here, and it's just late. And Herb says that Chaim Soloveitchik and the Rav were not on the same page. Rabbi Rakefet likes to say that Yaakov Katz had more influence on Chaim Soloveitchik than his own father, because he adopted the historical approach. And David says that Dr. Moshe Berry published an article. Does the Chazakah of Tava Meitav Nandu, can that change? And he discusses the Rav's unique position on the Chazakah. So there's a lot to say. Justin says that we don't pass an halacha based on archaeology. It seems terribly ironic that a piece of stone carved anonymously established a personal status without any other evidence of kahuna. That's an interesting point you make there. Rabbi Shud, now the last comment. You mentioned A Living Covenant by David Hartman. But that's an earlier work. His last book, which is a really interesting book, I think it's God Is Not Afraid or something like that. But the piece that Moshe sent me, which I could send anyone who was interested, I never heard really Rabbi Hartman speak. I mean, he's like a fire and brimstone preacher here, and he's talking about what we need, what we need for to revitalize Judaism in the modern day. And he says that all these people get up there and say you need to spend 20 years in yeshiva before you can understand, rabbinic theology. He says it's nonsense. And it's just a way of controlling you. He says the Torah was given in all the languages. And he's saying, it's fascinating. I'd never heard him before. So thank you very much. Lots of comments. If any of you, I didn't get to your comments because I went quickly down. If you think it's important, send it to me. And I'll begin next class with it. I didn't mean to miss anyone, but I'm looking at the time, and we start losing people as we go on, and we're supposed to only be an hour, 10 minutes. But so Rabbi Kelman.
On Kol HaMarva, we're in the Pesach spirit. Kol HaMarva HaRezim Shabbat. So okay, thank you. And in the Pesach spirit, tomorrow Dr. Sokolow, instead of his regular shiur on Chalutzim, will be talking on what is Charoset, and Rabbi Shon. Woman of 1 o'clock will be taught. He's not going to say like what ingredients, it'll be a little deeper than that. And Rabbi Shulman says to kids to ask, Kadeshi, Shaluat, what will we answer them? So those are the two shirim tomorrow. There are regular Tuesday presenters, but they'll be giving on Pesach tomorrow. And all through the week, every day, of course, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, my shir, and next Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, have shirim every day relating to Pesach. So please, we look forward to seeing you. Invite a friend. I hope everybody's doing well. And like we said at the beginning, for those who weren't here, don't cling too much. Not good. You're supposed to enjoy Pesach. We have bitul chametz. It's good enough. I mean, you have to clean a little, but don't drive yourself crazy. And it's really true. All the rabbanim, want to enjoy Pesach and be well. Okay, everybody, enough. And Laila Tov, thank you very much. We hope to see you soon. All the best. Bye-bye. Laila Tov. Laila Tov, okay.